Hello everyone and welcome back to Bizarre Tales. On today's episode we're going to be delving straight back into H.H. Holmes Part 3. If you haven't listened to Part 1 or Part 2 yet, I suggest you go back, give them a listen just so you don't feel lost. So without further ado, here is H.H. Holmes Part 3. Enjoy. In 1879, a doctor, Leslie Keeley, announced that he had found a cure for alcoholism. But Keeley treated alcoholism as a disease rather than an addiction or a dependence, and according to him, this disease could be cured with his groundbreaking procedure, also known as the Gold Cure. In order to rid yourself of alcohol disease, all you needed to do was book yourself into the Institute and treatment would begin, which was 4 injections of bichloride of gold 4 times a day, as well as other tonics. The patients were placed in hotels or local houses that also offered a spa-like experience, and after 4 weeks, the patient would be released, a new person, so to speak. It is thought that the injections contained gold salts and vegetable oils and even ammonia, but Keeley always kept the ingredients of the injections a secret and close to his chest. And because of this, his miracle cure was always met with scrutiny from the medical community, who claimed it was too good to believe that a cure for alcoholism could be administered and seen through to completion in only 4 weeks. Nevertheless, Keeley's business flourished, and for every patient he cured, he would then employ them to go out and promote the miracle cure themselves. And Keeley's slogan spoke for itself, which was, "Drunkenness is a disease, and I can cure it." One man who was drawn to the idea of the gold cure was Benjamin Peitzel, H.H. Holmes's right-hand man. Benjamin realised that the drink was slowly destroying him and something needed to be done. Or maybe Holmes thought it was best to rid this man of his alcoholism once and for all. After all, he relied on Benjamin and he was no good to him drunk or hungover. The procedure cost a cool $100, which for the day was quite expensive, possibly a sum of money that was out of reach for a man like Benjamin. So it is likely that Holmes paid for Ben to visit the Institute. Whether he was looking out for Ben or merely saw an opportunity to try and discover the ingredients of the gold cure for himself and make up his own version of the miracle cure is not entirely known. What is known is that Ben booked himself into the Institute in March of 1882, and by April of 1882 he had returned a new man, a sober man. It would seem that the gold cure worked. Well, maybe not, because it wasn't long before Ben started to once again crave the drink, and after a while he fell back off the wagon that he briefly climbed back upon. However, Ben found it hard to forget a woman he had met at the institution, who checked him into the program. No doubt he wasted no time in telling Holmes about the beautiful woman sat behind the desk of the Institute, as men tend to do. Ben informed Holmes with much enthusiasm about the 24-year-old tall blonde young lady that was a sight to behold, with glowing soft skin and an innocence about her. This lady was called Emmeline Sigrand. At this news, Holmes, who we all know now likes the ladies, wasted no time in visiting the Institute. Benjamin had already told Emmeline all about Holmes when he was being treated over the 4 weeks, and how he worked for such an important man, no doubt trying to impress her for himself. And because of this, in a way, she probably already felt familiar with the man she had never met. And it wasn't long before Holmes once again activated his charms and he won over Emmeline. Initially, he did this by writing to her and offering her a job at the castle as his private secretary, a great way to keep her close. And then he offered her a salary of $18 a week, a massive 50% increase over the wage Dr. Keeley was paying at the Institute. So how could she say no? As soon as she took the position, Holmes wasted no time in seducing her with expensive gifts, fancy dinners in fancy restaurants, and expensive trips to the theatre, as well as meeting for pleasant strolls through the park. And it wasn't long before he had totally won her over, and they had become an item. But bear in mind, Holmes was still married to Murta, who his customers often inquired about, as well as a first wife that no one knew of. But it was clear to see that Holmes and his secretary were now an item, and by the end of 1892 she expected Holmes to marry her, and he actually agreed to this and encouraged her to write the addresses of her closest relatives on 12 clear envelopes, and he would have some professional marriage announcements printed up and he would post them out. But he insisted that she refer to him as Robert E. Phelps, and she did so. As she sat there writing out the addresses one at a time, feeling like the happiest woman in the world, she had no idea that Holmes had already decided that she was going to die. Holmes was going to kill her. There are many theories as to why Holmes decided to kill Emmeline. It could have been that she simply knew too much of his business, or maybe, to him, it was the easiest course of action. But I think Holmes just simply wanted to kill. Maybe the urge had become too strong to ignore after the excitement and novelty had gradually worn off. Sometime during December of 1892, Holmes asked Emmeline to search for some important business papers that he kept inside the walk-in safe. And so Emmeline walked into the safe and proceeded to search for the papers in question, and while she was preoccupied, Holmes pushed the door shut and turned the wheel and locked Emmeline inside the safe. It is said that at first Emmeline was simply baffled as to what was going on. She had absolutely no reason to suspect Holmes of anything sinister and as cruel as what he had planned for her. She gradually started to realise that Holmes was not going to open the door, and she was now trapped in here and was finding it increasingly harder to breathe, and the acid that Holmes had covered the floor with was actually speeding up the process as the deadly fumes mixed in with the small amount of air that was in the safe. Outside, Holmes listened intently as she went from demanding the door be opened to pleading that the door be opened, and then to pure terror and panic as she realised she was going to die as she choked on the foul mixture of fumes in the air. And then she pushed with her feet against the door in one more final attempt to free herself. The acid that had been placed on the floor burned a perfect copy of her foot onto the steel of the safe door. Whilst Emmeline slowly and painfully choked to death on the floor of the safe, Holmes undid his trousers and pleasured himself over and over until he was satisfied and then relaxed content. Not long after Emmeline's death, Holmes took the addressed envelope she had filled in days before, stating that she had wed a gentleman named Robert Phelps. This was to make her family believe that Emmeline had simply run away with another man. And once again, Holmes paid once more for the flesh to be stripped from Emmeline's dead body and the skeleton professionally articulated and sold to another medical school for a pretty penny. In 1893, the World's Columbian Exposition, or as many came to know it as simply the Chicago World Fair, was being held in Chicago to celebrate the 400-year anniversary of Christopher Columbus and his voyage into the New World in 1492. The fair covered a massive 690 acres and brought together 46 nations who all participated in the fair and welcomed over 27 million visitors over its six-month run. This World's Fair was a very important event, and in a way it represented Chicago's rebirth after the Great Fire. But the fair also saw some truly revolutionary inventions, and showcasing some brand new styles in architecture and introducing some new cultural ideas. If you could step back in time and attend the fair, here are a few of the attractions you could have witnessed with your own eyes. You could have taken a ride on the world's very first Ferris wheel that stood an impressive 264 feet high. You could have seen life-size reproductions of Christopher Columbus's three ships, which were actually built in Spain and then sailed over to America for the World Fair. You'd have also seen the world's first moving walkway, where visitors to the fair could either sit or stand as a moving walkway took them directly to the casino. You could have also witnessed for the very first time the invention of the dishwasher, the zipper, the elevator, and the very first voice recording, as well as so much more. And Holmes had been preparing for the World Fair for quite some time, and when the World Fair eventually arrived in Chicago, it is said that Holmes had every room booked almost every night. Now, it is not entirely sure how many people met their end in the Murder Castle over the period of the World Fair being in Chicago, but one pulp magazine suggested that Holmes may have had over 200 victims over the time of the World Fair. Although this is highly unlikely, it's rumoured that maybe 50 tourists that stayed at the castle disappeared from the face of the earth and were never seen again, and they probably met their end as he pumped gas into their rooms as they slept. In fact, his staff would later comment on how many female guests simply ran away leaving their belongings behind, and Holmes simply didn't look concerned that he'd been cheated out of his room fee, when in fact it was the hotel guests that were cheated out of their lives, and then thrown down the grease chutes that made their way to the dark basement, where Holmes kept his dissecting table. In 1893, Holmes was once again on the prowl for another mistress, and it wasn't long before he had another woman in his employ. This lady was named Minnie Williams, and Holmes hired her as his personal secretary once again. And of course, it was not long before they were lovers. Unlike Holmes' past conquest, Minnie wasn't in the same caliber. She was described as naive and not very bright, but pleasant, short-legged and plump. In the book Deviant, she is described as an overgrown baby. It's safe to say she wasn't Holmes's usual type, but nonetheless, they were a couple. In fact, Minnie had one very alluring detail about her that Holmes could not resist. You see, when Minnie was younger, herself and her younger sister Nanny were adopted by two separate uncles. The uncle who took in Minnie was quite well off, and her life with him was very comfortable, and money was never an issue. But when Minnie turned 23, her uncle sadly passed away, but left her some property in his will that was valued at over $40,000. So in hindsight, it became painfully clear what it was that Holmes wanted. He wasn't interested in Minnie, he was interested in what she had. You see, at this particular time, Holmes was in a massive amount of debt. Although it never bothered him in the past, his creditors had now actually banded together and were applying a well-deserved amount of pressure to pay. So it wasn't long before Holmes worked his charms once again and somehow persuaded Minnie to somehow sign over the property to him. He obviously had her unconditional love and trust, and she was a very kind woman, and Holmes knew exactly how to exploit kindness. Now, seeing as Holmes already had the property signed over to him, this is a part where Holmes would usually kill his victim and send her flying down the grease chute to the basement. But there was another problem he needed to deal with first. You see, Minnie had started a new relationship with her sister, Nanny, who went living with the other uncle. And she quickly became a fixture in her life, which meant that Nanny knew about Holmes. Minnie had spoken fondly of him in letters to Nanny on many occasions, and this presented a problem. There could be absolutely no loose ends in Holmes's plans, so this meant that Holmes had decided that Minnie and Nanny both had to die. And so Holmes went about putting his evil plan in motion. One day, Holmes suggested that Minnie invite Nanny and they would all enjoy a day out at the World Fair, and so she did, and they actually visited the fair a few times during Nanny's visit. And it was during this time that Holmes was actually trying his best to win Nanny over, who was apparently at first rather suspicious of Holmes, but it didn't take long before he had her complete trust. On their last visit to the World Fair, Holmes suggested that Minnie return home and rest, and he would take Nanny to the castle, and he was sure around the building. And so Minnie returned home, and Nanny went with Holmes as he showed her around the mind-bending, confusing passageways of the castle. And when the tour was over, Holmes requested that Nanny help him with some very important papers he needed to get from the walk-in safe. As he led her into the safe, he quickly shut the door and locked Nanny inside, where she suffocated to death. Later, Holmes would return to Minnie, obviously without Nanny, and when Minnie inquired where her sister was, he told her that she was waiting back at the castle, and they were going to collect her on the way to dinner. An excited Minnie quickly got dressed, and then was escorted to the castle by Holmes to join her sister. That evening, Holmes dined alone, as Minnie suffocated back at the castle in his walk-in safe. It wasn't long before Holmes had once again met another woman who he quickly became engaged to once again. In fact, he had been visiting this woman whilst courting Minnie Williams, but at the time his attention was entirely on Minnie and her inheritance. But now, Minnie was out of the picture, along with her sister, and his attention was now fully on his new love interest, Miss Georgina York. 23-year-old Georgina was a blonde-haired young woman who was said to be very charming with blue eyes. As we know, Holmes was already married, and so he made up some extravagant story telling Georgina that both his parents were dead, which was a lie. He told her that his siblings had also died, and that his mother's brother had looked after him and become his only remaining relative, which was also a lie. And his uncle was to leave him all of his fortune in his will, but to do so he wanted Holmes to take his name, Henry Mansfield Howard, which was a lie. This was a great way to avoid suspicion when he eventually married again. Holmes was very adept at spinning the perfect lie, and lies flowed from him so easily it was like second nature. As well as the wedding, Holmes had more pressing things on his mind, mainly the amount of debt he had mounted up over the years, and now his creditors were pressing him and moving him for payment. And just like Holmes always eventually became bored of the women in his life, he had also become bored of the murder castle, and he decided it was time to bring this part of his life to a close and move on to other devious swindles, crimes and murders. And so, on a crisp, cold night in October, Holmes paid a man to set the castle alight. And so, the top floor and the second floor went up into flames. The top floor was totally destroyed and the second floor partially damaged, but the row of shops underneath remained untouched. Holmes had actually taken out multiple insurance policies against fire, and he intended to claim the money, which would have been a payout of $25,000. However, upon inspection, it was discovered that the fire looked very suspicious. As well as this, Holmes had actually raised a few red flags against himself with his past swindles. Ultimately, the insurance company refused to pay Holmes a dime, and Holmes simply walked away with no punishment. He had escaped the law once again. But Holmes was still in a lot of debt, and his creditors had actually hired a lawyer to get the money from Holmes, and if the money wasn't paid, a warrant would be made for his arrest. It was around this time that Holmes had come up with another scam. It would take a lot of planning and plotting. For this scam, Holmes would require the help of his goon, Benjamin Pitesell. Holmes explained that he planned to take out a life insurance policy on Benjamin's life and stage his death. He would then acquire a cadaver and badly disfigure it so it could pass off as Benjamin. And when Benjamin agreed, Holmes insured Benjamin's life to a total sum of $10,000. And with that, Holmes and his new wife left Chicago, along with Benjamin, who bid farewell to his wife and children for now, and they were next seen in Texas. The inclusion of Georgina, who was now Holmes' wife, was a complication, but Holmes simply lied through his teeth. He was good at lying, and she bought everything he said, completely trusting in her loving husband. He was making her believe that he was finalising some important business deals and taking possession of the ranch left to him by his loving, non-existent uncle that he had dreamt up. When in reality, he was there to claim the property he swindled out of Minnie, his dead fiancé, as well as planning the complicated life insurance scam him and Benjamin planned to see through. However, Holmes did like to pull off different scams whenever the opportunity arose, and one of the scams Holmes tried to pull off was a horse theft. But this did not go quite to plan, and it wasn't long before he had to flee Texas before the police could charge them with a crime. Once again, explaining to Georgina with pure fabrications as to why they were leaving in such a rush, and once again, she bought it. Over the many months, Holmes and Benjamin travelled from city to city looking for the perfect place to pull off the life insurance scam, dragging Georgina with them. But Holmes believed that he was unstoppable, and he wasn't afraid to take on more swindles. Whilst in St. Louis, Holmes once again purchased a pharmacy like he had done so many years before, promising the owners payment the next month, and then he went about stocking the pharmacy up to the brim with merchandise bought on credit, and then sold it all off to make quite a bit of money. He then made up a bill of sale for the store to a completely fabricated buyer named Brown, and when the creditors came calling, he simply showed them the bill of sale and insisted he was no longer the owner of the store. However, this didn't go to plan, and before Holmes could flee the city, he was arrested for the very first time and placed in jail in 1894 for 10 days. But for Holmes, this was actually a happy twist of fate. You see, whilst in jail, Holmes became quite friendly with a man named Marion Hedgepeth. Hedgepeth was a train robber, a very bad man, one of the last bad outlaws from the Wild West, and he had some very important information that Holmes was desperate to extract from him. And that is where we will leave it today. Join me next time on Bizarre Tales when we delve into part 4, the final part of our H.H. Holmes story. Until then, take care, and I'll see you very soon. Bye-bye.